I'm very sympathetic to the notion with which you began, that one might have, let's call them flashes of integrity, moments of integrity. In other words, that integrity is not going to be some sort of constant, persistent block of a thing, but you might have occasional moments of integrity. That feels also true to the kind of experiences that I've had and seen, you know. But I felt that as you talked, that other sense of this kind of, you know, continuous and rather oppressive integrity kept kind of trumping the flashes of integrity idea, so much so that there was a kind of a fierce opposition, actually, between this overriding principle of humanity, which, of course, is very easy to identify with and very beautifully stated, and between integrity as some kind of oppressive force. I don't feel this as an opposition like that. And, you know, as I was listening to you, I kept thinking, I don't know if it's fair to say this, I was like listening to the music of your presentation. It was a very musical, poetic presentation. What I kept hearing was a kind of sense, a profound sense of gentleness towards the self as a kind of organizing way of living or something like that, mm-hmm. you know? But I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I was hearing.
I like that. Wow, that's and beautiful.
I mean, that's what I heard in your voice, but I was thinking that that principle actually was beautifully consonant with what Amber was talking about yesterday when she was trying to, you know, define, not even exactly define, but let us say, draw in certain elements of what might be considered integrity.
Yeah. I agree with that, actually. Look, this is a bit of an exercise. It's deliberately meant that way, and it's a liminal exercise. It's an exercise in this liminal space, the Einstein Forum. I mean, I wrote this just for this occasion, to honor, first of all, two people that mean something to me, and to honor this institution in this occasion. And it's a space, the Einstein Forum is a space that is not in the academy, but draws on the academy in profound ways, and can inform the academy in very interesting ways. So there's a sense in which this is an exercise that's a liminal academic exercise. And one of the things I think we can do in the academy is be very precise with our language. Now, there are different ways to be precise with language. Amber, I think, did a good job yesterday of talking about how those of us who've been trained in analytic departments, or departments with at least a strong analytic component, can run a certain form of precision. There's also descriptive precision. And what I was doing in this exercise was trying to take, actually in a more, a writerly fashion, take seriously the connotations of integrity and to see what would happen if they're considered self-referentially, absolutely, you know, if we were to have integrity with the connotations of integrity. And so what that does is it creates, you're absolutely right, it creates a bit of a cartoon. I absolutely agree. But the point of that cartoon is to try to underline the extent to which when we're actually operating with a kind of integrity that makes plain practical sense to many of us. I don't think we're idealistic with language, actually. So this is actually supported by my argument. I think we're pragmatic with language. And we understand what we mean when we say that someone has integrity, more or less. We can point to things and we can slowly get closer to it. But anyways, when we do in everyday life talk about integrity, I would say that it's going to be contextualized through this deeper sensibility. And so what I was trying to do was use this precision with description to underline the extent to which our use of the word integrity is dependent upon an underlying sensibility. And I agree with your criticism. It's the effect of an exercise, but in a way, I don't know if this makes any sense. I do Aikido. I don't know if you know Aikido. So in Aikido, you don't attack people. You wait for someone to come, and you open a space so that someone can do something. And in a way, I've tried to open a space with this talk, and it's your kind of comment that I'm hoping somebody would give so that I can feed back to it. And that, again, is supported by the logic of the talk, because humanity is a collective endeavor. It's not me to come up here and own truth and tell you how you have to now go take it out into your life and live it. So does that help as an answer?
Yeah, I still don't fully agree with that. Yeah.
Oh, well, okay. Maybe you should, I'd like to hear the disagreement later, but we got to go on. Okay.
Thank you, Jeremy. I don't know if you'll see it this way, but I saw your talk as articulating what many of us found really troubling about Larissa's talk, and spent quite a long time until fairly late yesterday trying to get a grip on why we both felt scared, as Kostik said, guilty, as David said, ambivalent, as I said, just trying to, ambivalent, it's confused. But I want to now play the other side with reference to two things. I'm scared of democracy. You know, democracy didn't just, kill the wisest men in Athens. It just elected a person in France who very sober, reasonable people call fascist, okay? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for the same reason that I worry about democracy, I read one of Rancière's books, and I wasn't sure that I understood mm-hmm. it about the equality of the mm-hmm. school teachers. Was that what you were referring to? I just think it's wrong, okay? It's false. It's empirically, and while I, as somebody who's committed to the Enlightenment, certainly want to believe that we're all infinitely more educable than we currently are, and that includes those of us in this room as well as people out on the street, I don't think it's true, which is why I actually think Rawls's formulation is much better. Rawls's, dealing with intelligence, it's just a gift, like having blue eyes or a good voice, and one should consider it as not something one earned and try and do something with it, but it doesn't falsify, the empirical world. Given those problems, and also I am surprised by your talk, because your own work, you were one of the very first people before the rest of the world was talking about global warming and climate change and saving the Earth as a precondition of everything else. You were one of the very first people to do philosophical work on that. Mm-hmm. So I wonder how that fits into what you were saying.
So let me just do a little bit of it. Let me just say something else about this talk. So coming over to Europe, although this is Germany, not France, I wanted to engage a bit more with continental stuff. And as you know, when we were at Yale had this very strange relationship to continental stuff. I personally am very antipathetic to a lot of French theory. And we've talked about this. I find it very vague. It's frustrating. But I believe in kind of Emerson's method of looking at what people read in my own country. And lots of people read French theory. And so just the backstory on this, just briefly, is that I've been trying for, honestly, 20 years to make anything useful out of Deleuze and Guattari, first of all. This is really brief, because I know we have got time. When we lived in New Haven, there was a very interesting moment in my neurotic, my good neurotic early 20s, where I literally threw 1,000 plateaus and expressionism in philosophy out the window of my house and into a dumpster, because I was so mad at it. And I had only done that with one other book, and that was Julie. No, not Julie, excuse me.
Juliette.
No, not Rousseau, Sade. Yeah, it was too disturbing for me to read about that stuff. But in any case, so in this talk, I'm actually trying to just show some humanity with these theorists that I have a very ambivalent relationship to, and make something useful out of them. To take, again, this idea of philosophy as the construction of concepts, which Deleuze and Guattari talk about in their last book, and I'm trying to use them to help me construct this concept of a sensibility. So Rancière is in the mix of this, and I love philosophy of education, you know this. And so I started reading this book, and literally when I talked this book out with my classes, it lit a fire under my behind, and the behind of everybody in the class. It was really a very powerful book in a classroom. And that led me to give a seminar on Rancière at this last semester. And I went in saying to my students, I think this might really be a fad, but at least he's got some clear moral convictions. Sometimes he's empirically grounded, and he doesn't, like, his sentences are not just completely chock full of ridiculously vague words. And to our surprise, after we got into this book, we found out that when you talk this book, some of his books out, they're really, really interesting. So I will actually own that he's the first kind of person in a while I've read who's kind of an auteur that I've thought, yeah, there's some good stuff here. So about the axiom of the equality of intelligences, it's not a descriptive claim. It's regulative. It's an ethical position. And intelligence for him, again, is not a measurable quality. That's a performance ideal. It's just a bare capacity. So it might be better to say the equality, it might be better to say the axiom of the equality of subjectivity, where subjectivity simply means the bare power to live our own lives by our own lights. So in that sense, you can see how he was Foucault's student and how Foucault was basically maybe diluting but also trying to translate into his context some of Kant's ideas in What is Enlightenment. And so I think that when you talk about the axiom of the equality of intelligences, what you're talking about is respect for every person's capacity for enlightenment. Very simple Kantian idea. Now, that said, to get back to your deeper question, I think what I learned from Rancière is to understand democracy not as it's currently understood, just to put it really bluntly, as a way of sorting out who and what gets to lead us through mild deliberation and half-hearted voting, combined with great degrees of administrative management and private sector pressure put on these decisions. But democracy is a moment where people insist on the equality that people have between each other in opposition to any kind of situation that would foreclose or read that equality out. So for Rancière, the classic case of democracy is the lunchroom sit-ins, lunch counter sit-ins in the civil rights movement. So democracy for him is a very circumscribed thing. The rest of the stuff he calls the police. So when I'm thinking, and the police, we need police, we need policing in our world, but he thinks in his attempt to do something that's dialectical but not Hegelian, he's trying to constantly think of the tension between this moment of opposing policy, what he calls the police, and the need to restore order when that opposition has occurred in the name of the equality of people's powers of subjectivity. So that said, sorry, this is a little longer than I wanted it to be. That said, I think that his take on the recent election in France, his take on the French state, and my take on your fear of democracy is that we're not really talking about democracy in these cases. I'm not going to speak about France because I'm not clear enough about it, but in the United States, there's very little democracy. So when I mean democracy, I mean it in a different sense. I mean that democracy is going to be found in a world where each of us have the equal capacity to live our own lives in Kant's sense, and where we have to structure our decision making with that as the fundamental kind of fundamental axiom. So, I mean, it's a very radical position, actually. Radical, I don't mean that we're burning things down necessarily, but it goes kind of to the root of the unit of persons and insists on it, and then kind of uses that to illuminate all the different ways in our world where we think we're doing democracy, where there's no democracy at all. People are not really listening to each other. There's not really collective deliberation. There's all sorts of forms of trying not to listen to other people, to try not to think deeply about things. And this is just a bunch of crap. It's not democracy. So, sorry, that was long.
I have first, thank you very much for the very inspiring and energetic talk. I have a brief question on the way that you use the word norm. I'm, I, I completely share your intuition that there's something rigid, dogmatic, maybe even reactionary to the term, that there's a potential to that extent to the term integrity. I'm not sure that I'm convinced that humanity solves those problems. You said that you were trying to come up with a concept of humanity that is first non-idealist, which I support in any sense, and second, non-normative. And I wonder how that's possible. If humanity is a descriptive term, does it not become trivial? Would be the first part to the question. The other one is that norms, I mean, if I refer this back to the history of normality, usually the norms that are highly visible, that go with technologies of government or so, are the less dangerous than those that are invisible. Mm-hmm. In this sense, totally. The way that you refer to humanity, or the way that you would like to replace integrity by a term of humanity, that comes with the rhetorics of subversion and an aesthetics of deviance, is or seems like a part of a new dispositive of normality that could be referred to maybe as a flexible normality. This would be a term
post-Foucauldian
by Jung. Yep. So in that sense, how can the concept of humanity that works with deviance and with non-normality, how can that evade being normative?
Yeah, now good point. So again, in answer to the first question, this is a bit of an exercise. So insofar as it is an exercise, it's working from pretty precise connotations to terms and trying to think about where those connotations might lead us. And the oppositions or objections that I raise to those connotations are meant to get us to shift our attention to a different kind of object. Okay? First of all, the first thing I want to say is that deviation obviously is tied to the concept of a norm. That's another way to say what you're saying. I am not espousing deviation in and of itself, but I'm espousing a sensibility that would allow us to see that basically that would allow us to see how we muddle through life and how we how when people are given the space to muddle through life and to develop their responsibility for their own lives, people can figure stuff out. That's why I started with the early childhood example. I mean, I'm Rousseauian in that sense. I think that, I mean, one of the books I've worked on, Susan mentioned the books I've written on environmental stuff, which I did basically because I don't consider myself an environmentalist, but I thought that there were some practical issues that needed to be sorted out. Well, one of the things that, another book I worked on was a book on early childhood education in poor neighborhoods in Chicago. It was using this Italian approach called the Reggio Emilia approach. It's a kind of, there's a lot to say about it. But one of the things I learned about in studying childhood development is I learned really to have so much confidence in the intelligence of children's bodies and kind of learn to develop a different sensibility of how it is that children learn to internalize their own, develop their own authority, internalize their relationship to other people, and so on. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that this is it'd take a lot longer than I can do up here, is that it seems to me that the aesthetics of the norm, which also creates the aesthetics of deviance because they're tied together, just doesn't fit a world in which you have faith in the intelligence of people, starting with little kids, to be able to sort things out to a large degree by themselves or with each other, without having to be kind of kept in line all the time. And so I'm really just trying to suggest that we look at that different object and take it seriously. But I would, otherwise than that, I would completely embrace your critique. And just as I said that I was trying to deal with some of the things that I've been ambivalent about in French theory, I was actually also trying to deal with a set of terms in American positive psychology culture that I hate. I hate everybody walking around and saying, "Don't be so rigid. Just be flexible, man." I mean, it drives me insane. But I was actually trying to make something good out of them. So I take your critique, and I think it's a good one. Did I answer it? Yeah, okay.
I hate to do this, I'm really enjoying the discussion, but I'm going to really enjoy the discussions to come.
Yes.
And we have 2 minutes.
We have three people, and maybe they could just say what they want to say, and then over lunch, Jeremy can reply. We'll
okay.
Give Jeremy two seconds to answer. We've got Sam, Misha, and Rudiger. So Sam's up here.
Question. Excuse me. It's more of a comment, and I'll try to be brief. You have received thank you in sharpening. You have received some of the essence of what I was trying to say, and I'll say it sharply. I think you have put up a little bit of a straw horse by giving attributes to integrity of absoluteness, immutability, and then I think integrity is a quality, it's a special quality of certain individuals who become moral, and it's precisely their ability of change that makes them special. And a particular person I have in mind, it's also interesting, for a good while I was listening to you, humanity, I thought of humanity as humanity in terms of precisely the person I want to talk about just a second, Hans Bethe, who was the head of the theoretical division at Los Alamos, probably the man as responsible, the second most responsible person in making the operation, if you want to call it successful, the creation of an atomic bomb, who thereafter really spends his life trying to come to terms on how do you contain it. Mm-hmm. And deeply, and he develops integrity, and it's this integrity by virtue partly of mastery, by virtue of personality, that allows him to come and come to the nuclear test ban treaty in 62 to 64, and by virtue of integrity is able to convince the Soviets, and understanding what their position is, to come eventually on the technical side to make this possible. Mm-hmm. So what I want to say, there it's a concern for humanity, which brings him to that, and your quality of humanity, his humaneness, is a global quality which all of us ascribe to as individuals being part of this humanity. There is something much more local about having integrity. It's specified in a given situation, a given time. It changes and is adaptable to a changing and a rapidly changing world. And so I had difficulty with your presentation precisely because I. Okay, thank you. But
yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. I'll pass in the interest of time.
Rudiger? Hello.
Hello. Thanks. A very academic question, I'm afraid, but at least brief. You had a lot of points of reference from Schelling to Nancy. But wouldn't be a very good one, a short one, without detours, Habermas, given what you said about personality and democracy and so on?
Hmm. Thank you. Can I say one thing just as I'm in? I will talk with each of you after the break because I appreciate your comments.